Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 1st, 2020, and welcome to episode 225, the 10th anniversary episode of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and today, reflection. And I don't mean the kind that you see in the mirror, although we may do a little bit of that, but I don't see myself because for some reason on the video, they tell me that they can see me, but I don't see me. It's really weird. Technical difficulties across the board today, but it's okay. I know what I look like.
Does this mean you're a vampire, perhaps?
It might. I have no reflection. Exactly. Oh, man, the jig is up. Anyway, I'm joined by other esteemed members of the roundtable, including but not limited to Paul Hagstrom. Paul, how are you today?
I'm good. Yes, I'm good. That's it. That's
are
all.
You feeling celebratory for our 10th anniversary?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to imagine that it was 10 years ago that this started. But and I wasn't even, you know, I wasn't there then, but still, it doesn't seem that long ago.
It really doesn't. I think this is one of those true cases where time flies when you're having fun. Yeah.
But generally, it's fine. There's been a little bit of snow, so winter is starting to arrive.
Ah, not here yet. Yeah. We're actually having a nice temperate day here in Portland. So happy about that. So what about the weather your way, Blake? And how are you, sir?
I am doing well. Excited to be part of the 10th anniversary episode. This is only my first year as part of the show, but I've been listening for most of the 10, if not every episode, I think certainly the vast majority. And the weather is actually, it sounds as if you and I are sharing sort of a like scenario outside. It's pleasant. Just went for a nice lengthy walk before the show. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, what about you, Jack? Talk about yourself. Talk about the weather.
Well, here in Stockholm, it's getting very dark very early. So now, right now as recording this, it's 10:30 p.m. here, which means it's already been dark for, I don't know, a solid 8 hours, maybe. I don't know. It gets dark so early. It gets so quickly. Like there's a certain like scoop of the curve towards wintertime where like it gets darker and darker and noticeably quickly. And somehow, and I think also we have the time change. We had a week ago, which means it, you know, brings it even one hour earlier. And I'm just like in like hibernate mode. Every afternoon, it's like, oh, I should just go to bed now because it's 3 p.m. I'm just tired. I'm just like, the sun sets and it's like, oh, here we go. I'm going to go take a snooze. So
that's what the northern latitudes will do for you. You get those awesome long days in the summer, but when the winter comes, it's payback time.
Yeah. And I'm not, you know, I've been here for decades and this year it's hitting me harder than it usually does. And I don't know why. I'm just sleepy. I just want to curl up. And maybe it's also because, it's Corona times. I'm wearing pajamas all day long anyway. It's just like,
yep.
I was going to say, it's not like 2020 hasn't had its share of things to make us tired.
Yeah. So, but I'm glad to be here with y'all for our 10-year anniversary.
Well, I'm really glad to be here with you guys. And today we decided for our 10th anniversary that we're going to make the show a bit on the personal side. Talk about what being on the RCR or podcasting has meant to us and what the retro computing hobby has meant to us. Kind of, you know, a very special episode of the RCR. And I guess we can kind of go around the round table here like we normally do. Who wants to go first? Any takers? All right, then I'll pick. Paul, you're first.
Right. Sure. Yeah. You know, so I was a listener, like actually everybody but Earl here, to the Retro Computing Roundtable, you know, and commenting, you know, frantically about like whatever, making jokes about what was being said, or you know, suggesting other things to talk about, or saying, well, actually, or whatever, and that was a lot of fun, and it's been neat to sort of like join this community, and you know, sort of feel like we have all of these friends that share this background of shared assumptions, so we don't have to explain ourselves. You know, we don't have to, it's not, you don't have to give this like 20 minute preamble about like what old computers used to be and why they're interesting before you get to the little thing about how this opcode works. So, yeah.
Right.
So that's been really fun. And it's been really, I think it's been, you know, I've had a blast, you know, sort of just doing some of the, kind of the production stuff too. I mean, like that's been kind of a neat angle on this too. It's a kind of a creative outlet of a sort that I didn't have. So I've really appreciated that. You know, I think it has enhanced my life.
Well, I try to say it as often as I can, but the work you do on the audio and the production for the RCR is stellar, and I'm glad that you enjoy doing it because I really enjoy you doing it. I love the. Yeah.
That's a lot of work. That's a lot of work, folks.
Indeed. Definitely. Yeah, a lot of work. And the end product is definitely worth it.
Thanks.
Absolutely.
So was that it?
I guess. I don't know. I didn't think that hard about like what I was going to say, really. But I'm sure I'll think of something as everybody else says more sensible things.
Well, yeah. I mean, it. You know, it's an interactive dialogue here. If you think of more things as we go. Or even maybe later shows, because I'm definitely on this topic hoping to catch up with Carrington and Michael and Quinn and, mm-hmm. you know, other folks to ask them the same question.
Right.
For them personally, what is this hobby? What's podcasting meant to them? So,
and I also have this this advantage that I can say something smart later and pretend, you know, everyone out there in the world will think I just said it earlier. Because I am the editing.
Cut and paste, yep, is your friend.
That's right.
Unless somebody's watching live, and then they're going to know the truth. Yeah.
If you're the editor, then you can consider yourself disattached from time. Yeah. So, yes.
Well, were we live when we were joking that you were a Time Lord, Blake? Because
I think we were not.
Yeah. I think we weren't. I think we weren't. Yeah.
Blake has a TARDIS. It's somewhere back there behind the screen.
That's right.
You can't see it.
Coming in circuit is working now, so it's not so easy to see.
It's tucked in there somewhere. But I'm happy to go next if you're done, Paul.
Yes.
Okay. I guess, you know, I started not when it was a retro hobby, but I guess, you know, since I had a great time with the home computers, starting off in 82 with my first, and then, you know, in a fickle fashion, I'm more of a curiosity really of all the different, you know, platforms, because back then every new system was really an entirely new ecosystem, very different than today. So I jumped and jumped and jumped into the 90s, and then, you know, I ended up on either PC or Mac. But it was, I guess around, you know, the turn of the millennium, 99 or aught, I started, it occurred to me it might be nice to, you know, grab a machine or two from my past that I enjoyed. And it turns out that was a fun thing. And that sort of grew. And as, you know, you can see behind me, can't really pan the camera, but there's a lot of panning that could happen and you'd still be seeing the machines. But yeah, so the retro thing, I mean, it's basically a nostalgia for me. I have very few systems that I didn't have back in the day, unless they were, you know, one or two very particular, very expensive items that you could, you know, get for nothing now that I really wanted. So that actually, that interest kind of connected with what I was doing at my work as a web developer at the time. setting up blogs for a campaign of sorts. I started off my Bite Seller blog in 2004, so that was 16 years ago. So I've really enjoyed blogging. It wasn't my first blog. Technically, I had other static little sites that were computer related, but it was my first retro thing and retro writing. And obviously, I've enjoyed that. That's actually at least half of the retro experience is writing about it. I guess that pie chart of, you know, where do I get the retro joy has had a new slice in this year coming onto the RCR podcast. I've been listening to for most of the 10 years, I think all the 10 years, but again, maybe not every show. But before this, I started listening to, it was actually Earl there with his RetroBits podcast. I remember it was about a year after he started it in 06 or so. I started listening and I was, you know, pushing my daughter in a stroller, like on a vacation at the beach when I was listening, you know, trying to find something to listen to. And I started and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. So that got me into retro computing podcasts. And then you all, I'm now part of it, but RCR managed to destroy Earl's blog, her podcast by absorbing him. So that went away. But RCR is the better for it. And it's still, it's been a nice piece of, staying up to date on what's happening. And there's a lot that's happening anew, things that are, you know, with FPGAs, devices, there's the capability to really extend these old machines in ways that you never imagined you could. And, this show always, was a big part of keeping me abreast of, what was out there. And as part of the show, I like to, I do what I can to bring in, not that everyone else isn't bringing in, plenty of occurrences and it's nice to see how many we talk about on these shows. So it's been a good, it's been a nice part of my life, I guess. It's like really one of the, one of the major ways, if not the major way, I spend, free time when I'm not, involved with family in this or that activity. It's nice to come back to. And it's made quite a difference in my life. And I've gotten a great deal from it. And I don't see, that stopping. And the nice thing about retro is it's that rolling window. Eventually everything becomes retro. this iMac I'm sitting at will one day I'll have be able to, oh yes, I've reproduced iMac that I recorded the 10th anniversary of RCR.
Take photos. Yeah.
Yeah. So it just keeps going. But yeah. Anyway, so yeah, that's a lot of words about retro computing for me. And that's about all I will say here.
So. I do remember feeling like we could guess when your lunch hour was, because it's like, then the stream of tweets comes about the episode that just got posted.
yeah, definitely. I'll listen to half the show and then like, okay, and then wait, and then okay, here's the next day, the second half of the show. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, in a way, there is a little bit of a negative to being part of the show because it isn't quite, I can't quite get that as pure, relaxing entertainment.
Very cool. Well, what about you, Jack?
Well, for me, it's interesting. I really haven't been a collector in a large scale or like a big user of retro systems continuously. I mean, I was using computers like the rest of you early as I reasonably could. I had my first Atari 400 in, I think, 1983. But with all through the 80s and into the 90s, like I would have a system and then I would use it and sell it and get something else. So I never sort of like was building a hoard. I just had like an old computer that I would get rid of and then get something new. And whether that entailed changing platforms or not, just like that's just kind of what I did. It's like the only things that I kept at all from the earliest days are some joysticks, really. Some Atari joysticks. I did do a little bit of Atari 2600 cartridge collecting in the 90s when I managed to just randomly, I had a neighbor in my apartment building who was selling she just dropped by. She's like, do you want to buy a video game? She had an old Atari 2600 and some games. And I was like, yeah, okay. And then I started collecting cartridges. I think there was a Usenet group that I was buying cartridges from. There was like there, and they were kind of like, and I don't remember what this group was called, but I remember at the time there was kind of a standardized sort of price list, like combat cost a dollar, whatever. There was like kind of a rarity scale of what cartridges were. And there were now and then there'd be somebody who'd say, hey, I've got these things for sale. You know, ping me if you want to buy some of them, that kind of thing. But then for a long time, I didn't really sort of collect anything at all. And it was first like at some point five or six years ago, and I don't remember the exact sequence of events. It's both at some point that I noticed that Paul was involved in RCR, because some of you know, Paul and I have been friends for 30 years, you know, since college. So we haven't always had a lot of direct contact, but at some point I noticed he was tweeting about this. And I was like, wait, okay, that's interesting. And somewhere around the same time is also when I discovered the Antic podcast had launched, and that was really cool. And also somewhere in that time frame is when I first looked up and picked up an old Atari 130XE that I found somebody here in Sweden selling. And that's sort of like kicked me off on this adventure of actually using this older stuff again, which I had not done for a long, long time. I guess the closest I'd come to actually using an old computing platform was about 20 years ago, an acquaintance had an old Mac. I want to say it was a 2CI or 2CX or something like that, an older system that I got from him, and I had it at home for a while, and my daughter, who was very small at the time, she had it in her room. She could play with. There was like a little paint program on there and stuff, and at some point, it stopped working, and I just took it to the recycling center and just left it. Like, it did not occur to me at the time. Honestly, I wasn't thinking about it. It didn't occur to me that there were hobbyists out there collecting this stuff and wanting to do things with it. And probably whatever was wrong with it was probably a simple fix for someone who knew what they were doing. But I just didn't – it didn't, like, occur to me that, hey, I should find someone who maybe knows what to do with this, or maybe somebody who just wants to have this. So – I committed it, my first retro computing sin at that point in time, I guess. But, you know, that's what happens. But so now I like you guys said, I'm very happy to have this sort of this community of people who get it. You don't have to explain, because otherwise if I bring this topic up at work or among, you know, casual acquaintances, they'll be like, what do you mean? Or like, the 20 minute intro of what this hobby is and why anyone would do it, kind of thing. So I don't know. I like that. And it's been really fun to see the explosion of things that have happened for all the various platforms, you know, the interesting hardware solutions, the new things that come up that, you know, like you said, things that no one would have dreamed of at the time that enable us to do some pretty great things and use our old computers in fun ways today. So I'm happy to be a part of this community, and I'm, you know, I don't always have, these days I almost never seem to have fun things I found on eBay, but I love being part of the podcast and talking to you guys, and just like, it's just a great time. And to me, it's something that, you know, suddenly I find myself having, I guess I have three different Atari 8-bit systems now, and I have an Atari portfolio, and I've got different other game systems and things that I've sort of like picked up over the past half decade that I would not have been thinking about at all. And these things have all been sort of fun to kind of pick up and play with and do things with. So, you know, it's all about nostalgia, and it's, I don't know, I've heard it said that nostalgia is a toxic impulse. And I think there can be a hint of truth to that, but it can also just be a lot of fun. So I don't know. I think that nostalgia is not a bad thing necessarily, unless it maybe goes too far. But who's to say what's too far?
Yeah, I mean, you could probably come up with some benchmarks on that, but I don't want to do it because I'm scared I'd be over the line.
That's right. Well, I've posted a number of photos in my Flickr galleries of the old systems, and I may have mentioned this before, but one of the photos showed my daughter, who was a toddler at that point, you know, kind of crawling around on the floor of the computer room here while I had been unboxing some things. And all of my photos basically are on Creative Commons, you know, attribution license, so people can use them. I like to see where they go. This was used as the headline banner for a story on hoarding and the effects that it can have on families. So I think that publication would have said that I had gone too far as far as a you know, kind of a yardstick, but I would have to disagree. I don't think there was anything scary going on there. So anyway, amusing.
Yeah, and I guess I would say that, like, you know, it's one thing if you're sort of like looking around saying, it was just better. But we are at least partially looking at these in terms of like history, right? So historians are not engaging in toxic impulses necessarily.
Right.
Right. Right. And, you know, along with that comes that maybe there were actually some things about the computer industry that were healthier back then. Mm-hmm. And maybe there were some things that were not, that are much better today. And I think looking at it and having a bigger swath of history to kind of compare it to lets you evaluate that with some context, as opposed to just thinking the only thing that's worth anything is the super high tech that we have today.
Yeah. But there is one thing that I often think about. You know, I often think about this with relation to the Apple III, but it works with almost any of these, that technology did move so quickly. I mean, maybe I don't know if it's moving more quickly now. It probably is and isn't in various ways. But I do think that there's like a bunch of stuff that these old machines could do in principle that nobody ever got around to, you know, because the next thing came along. And so there's still some like actual exploration and stuff that can be done that hasn't been done before on these because the, you know, the time span was too short. So.
Right. Yeah. I think like one prime example of that is just things like the extremely primitive graphics of the Atari 2600, which nowadays people are making homebrew games that are absolutely amazing given the hardware. And like you can look at the original batch of games Atari made. It's clear that the designers, the hardware didn't have today's games in mind. They had very simplistic stuff in mind, but they happened to create something that, you know, given enough time and enough sort of consideration of how to use this, people have come up with techniques based on this old stuff that can do things that look miraculous by comparison now.
Mm-hmm. But they still would have run.
But it seems like not just in, you know, I mentioned the hardware, FPGAs, and how you can, you know, utilize this new cheap, very cheap, typically hardware to, you know, tie an old machine to the net or do this or that. The modern software, like, because these people are using, typically they're using a build tool chain, you know, that's using like a modern machine with a cross compiler often to, you know, sort of make easier the process. It's hardware is the same, you know, they just, there are better tools. And that's really, I guess, to me, that's more amazing than actually, you know, oh, here's this new hardware. I can do these new things. And that's awesome. But look what this guy did on this hardware. This thing could have run back in 1978 on an Atari 800. You know, like that's actually a bigger shocker and kind of a more exciting thing, I think. What about you, Earl?
I wrote down a couple things because I guess maybe I got nostalgic about being nostalgic. Because there were several milestones for me this year of involvement in the retro computing hobby. One was that I got started with this in the year 2000, and very similar to, I think, your experience that you talked about, Blake, where I was just, you know, eBay was getting popular and I was just thinking, I just had this flash thought. It was weird. I wonder if I could find one of the old computers that I used to use on eBay. I mean, this is, you know, the internet-wide garage sale, right? I bet somebody out there has that. And it turned out that it was true. I found a VIC-20. And so I went ahead and I bought it, and it got shipped to me, and it made it through the shipping experience without getting destroyed, which was awesome. And I plugged it in. I was playing around. I was like, wow, you know, this is a lot of fun. I wonder if anybody else is doing this. So I went out and I checked the internet news groups and I checked some blogs and I looked around. It turned out there were some people involved with retro computing even back then. I thought this would be fun to get involved with. And I guess the rest is, you know, history, I guess, as they say. And it's been kind of history since then. So history of history. I broke it up into three categories. And the first one that meant something to me about being a part of the hobby is community, and present company included. I've really enjoyed meeting people through the retro computing hobby, both online and in person. It's just been a huge amount of fun. So many great friends. This is particularly the case through podcasting. Just a lot of people have reached out through listener feedback or one way or another, or met somebody at the local user group, and they're like, oh, yeah, you do the Retrobits thing? And then we talked about that. And so lots of great friends and, you know, friends that have stayed friends throughout a lot of years. I think in terms of participating in retro computing, it's fun to do projects, but it's really fun if you're doing the projects and you're learning about computer history and doing some of the other things we do in retro computing archiving and that with other people who enjoy it. Like a couple of you said, you don't have to explain the context of it. You don't have to put up with the funky side eye, you know, like, why would you do that? Which is funny because they don't ask people that about things like old cars or old, you know, grandfather clocks or other things that people restore. But if you tell them I do old computers, it's like, oh, uh-huh. But, you know, it turns out not only do you have a shared context about retro computing, but the people involved in retro computing also, I find, frequently have a lot of other shared interests as well. Things like maybe modern technology and programming or sci-fi. We were talking about Doctor Who earlier, or things like that. So lots of built-in friends there. And the get-togethers have been great. I've only been to a small number of the festivals, including one of the in-person Kansas Fests. But every time, it's been a really positive experience. And I guess on the community side, it's also been gratifying and, to be honest, a little humbling to hear from some of the listeners who, because of the podcasting we did on Retrobits or RCR or whatever, have been inspired to build a project or archive some software, some documentation, learn about a new system that they hadn't played with before, or even in some cases start a blog or a podcast or a video channel or whatever of their own. So, you know, like any community, it hasn't been all roses, but it has been mostly roses. By and large, the retro computing enthusiasts that I've encountered have been great people, happy to share information, to talk about the projects they're doing, just have fun. If somebody asked me, I would categorize the hobby as high action and low drama, which is just the perfect sweet spot for me. So that's one thing. And then projects was the second category. I've only got three, so don't worry. I won't suck up an hour here. But making podcasts or listening to podcasts, either one, can result in buying things. You might have actually encountered that, Paul, understand.
Occasionally it does happen, yes.
What are you talking about, Earl? I don't understand.
And it also can result in fixing things or building things that you might not have otherwise known about. So it's been great exposure. And it's an investment in time and money, you know, sure, like any hobby, but it's a lot of fun. I've had some recent things that I was thinking of that were great fun. One was a recent build project where I breadboarded a surprisingly accurate VT100 emulator, a hardware-based emulator based on the ESP32 microcontroller. That was super fun because I wanted something that would be a high-fidelity emulator of the VT100 and some of the funky things it can do. And, you know, if you think about it, there's a good chance somebody's done it, and you can go out and you can get the plans and then you can do it. So that's what I did. And, you know, you talk about the cheap circuitry, Blake, the ESP32, you can find these little boards for $5 or less that run that. And then you can plug them in and do things with them. It's just great. Also, I had archaeology just yesterday, in fact, making a ROM dump. It turned out that one of the disk controller boards that I got with the pile of Altair stuff was a pretty rare board, and nobody had ever archived the ROM contents from it. So I was working with an Altair super genius who was helping me set up the right kind of, again, you know, the community thing, somebody helping me set up the right configuration so we could dump the ROM. It was awesome. It was super fun. These activities, this kind of stuff would have never come my way other than through being either involved with or plugged into listening to podcasting. So one of the other things that, man, I'm really trying to steer a course around, I'm getting kind of worried about how much time I could spend with the Fujinet adapter if I wind up getting one of those. Because it's an awesome community and it's a great device. And I know I could get, you know, pulled into a time vortex.
Right.
So, and then the third thing was history. The collective knowledge of the retro community is almost unbelievable. I just am constantly floored at what people know about computer history and about these old systems. You learn so much by being a part of the hobby. Hmm. It's been a pleasure not just to learn about the history, but I actually had a couple of chances to capture some of it, which, or, you know, folks that I know capturing history. Like, I think the Antic podcast folks have interviewed almost anyone involved with the Atari 8-bit computers ever. Like, anybody who could spell Atari got an interview. And that's great for capturing that for posterity. And I had the chance personally to speak with some heroes of mine. Chuck Peddle, Stuart Chaffee, Bill Hurd, Leonard Trammell. I got to exchange emails with people like Jim Butterfield and Dan Bricklin. And I never would have thought in a million years that I would have had the chance to do that. Honestly, I'm still a little shocked by that. But it's super fun. And, you know, so when you think about computer history, I know somebody mentioned earlier historians, and there are formal methods to record history. And I have a huge amount of respect for that. But I think, honestly, with this hobby, the informal efforts of the amateur historians in the retro computing hobby has collected such a vast repository. I feel like we've really, we've kind of captured computer history in HD. You know what I mean? There's so much material that's been archived. I mean, look at what Jason Scott and the Internet Archive have done, just, you know, as one example for capturing computer history. So
right.
I guess to sum up, it's been about friends, fun, and history. And we talked about nostalgia. I enjoyed being part of computing in the 80s. It was a super fun time. And a couple of times I kind of wish I could go back to that time. But honestly, I think I have more fun with 80s computing today than I did when it was actually the 80s. So that's my spiel, and you're stuck with it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Nice.
Very nice.
Yeah, I was thinking, as you know, as all of the rest of you were talking, I was thinking, ah, yes, okay. So you were. I misinterpreted the topic a little bit. I was trying to think about like how to talk about the, you know, RCR itself in a way, but maybe I can say a little bit about just kind of like how I got into this, because it's true. I feel like I say this a lot, but at the same time, it just gets scattered throughout little episodes and things. But, you know, when I was basically just kind of getting started in the into going back into retro, like vintage stuff, it was primarily because I had seen something that Jason Scott had posted. This would have been like 2012 or 2011 or something like that, which said basically, you know, I think people refer to this blog post fairly often, but it was essentially saying, okay, you know, you blew it, you know, all your discs are now dead. You waited too long, you know, it is now too late. And I thought, oh no, that's not good. And I had all these discs and I've been carting them around, and, you know, because, you know, for the stuff that I'd done when I was a kid and on the Apple II, I had the floppies. And I had actually one other thing that I was thinking about is that, like, throughout all that time between when I was using the Apple II and when I read this post about how I had blown it with my discs, I always did have an Apple II emulator somewhere. But, you know, like, I didn't really use it all that seriously, but, you know, I had a little things that were on the Mac, and I had a little thing on my Trio, you know, so that I had it set up so that, you know, if I typed C030 on my phone, it would click, because that's what the Apple II emulator would make it do. But it was really that it was this like feeling like, okay, I have to salvage my floppies, that got me to, go out and get an Apple IIgs. I saved the tweet where I said, like, you know, I'm thinking about buying an Apple IIgs. and then I did, and that was sort of the beginning of everything. But definitely my own journey started as kind of an archival one. You know, it was kind of fun to be able to look at the old games, but I could do that on an emulator. It was really getting a computer that could read the floppies that was really the driver for it. And then the sort of second thing of getting an Apple II GS, which I never had, you know, that was always like the big fancy, you know, the computer that was just beyond me a little bit. It had banks of memory I didn't understand, and you know, it was all very complicated, and the screen was blue. I didn't understand any of that. So anyway, yeah. So that was kind of how I got into it, and then you know, sort of snowballed from there as I started realizing there's all this interesting stuff I didn't know, and then the community followed. But yeah, I think I went. So I was at the Kansas Fest, Earl, that you were at. And
you were,
yeah,
yeah. It was fun to meet you.
I forget if that may have been my first one, but I remember finding it very strange. And I guess the people who are watching the live stream won't have this, you know, sort of effect. But and it's the same effect that you always have when you see like a public radio show being, you know, performed in front of you or whatever. Like these people don't. It's very weird to hear these voices you know coming out of this head you don't.
Right.
So that was it was a little strange talking to you a little bit there because it was this weird disconnect. Like I knew your voice so well. But
I've heard that. I've heard, you know, especially in the earlier podcast days before we started doing the video stuff, mm-hmm. that people would say, "Wow, I thought you looked so much different than what you do." And I was never sure quite how to take that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not like I noticed that I don't have an image. I don't really have an image exactly. It's just not, but still when you see the person, it's not quite the same. I mean, I remember noticing this like, I've seen Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me get like taped a couple of times. And I know like the host of that, I had no idea, you know, what he looked like, but it wasn't my guest.
Yeah, I'll say I remember the first time I saw, I guess it was quite a while. I think, if I'm not mistaken, RCR did a few video mm-hmm. streams on special occasion, but it was well before it was, you know, regular. And I saw Earl. We're going to go back to Earl for the first time. And I had a very specific image of Earl in my mind as far as what he looked like. And it had nothing to do with the way Earl actually looks. And again, it's not a bad thing, and not a old or a young or a bad or whatever. I don't know why I had such a distinctive you know, maybe it's because you were podcasting alone for like an hour and a half with mm-hmm. Retro Bits, and it did drill itself into my head. I don't know. But yes, I had the Earl experience mm-hmm. as well.
But it is pretty fun, you know, to like it is a small enough community and there are enough people podcasting actually now that you have this feeling like, you know, you're already friends in a way, like the first time
That's
you
true.
Actually meet.
Yeah.
So.
Right. I think you're right.
And I enjoyed that a lot. Like, I mentioned one of the local users group that I was standing in line. We were standing in line to grab a slice of pizza or something like that. I was talking with somebody and somebody else in the room turned around and just gave me this really crazy kind of look. And, you know, I was like, what? And it was like, I know that voice. But I didn't. But the fun thing was there was an instant rapport there, you know, and we were able to fire up a conversation about one thing and another. And it was, that kind of small world sort of thing was really fun in this community.
Hmm.
Excellent. Nice.
Speaking of community, should we move on to listener feedback?
Sure.
Sure thing.
Sure.
So I think Paul and Blake, you guys were going to double team that this time.
One of the items Curtis emailed in, and this was actually I think probably a couple of maybe a month back. We don't always get to all the feedback, for which we apologize, but we had been discussing the Tandy Coker 3, Color Computer 3. There was I don't recall specifically what we were saying about it. But one of the things that I mentioned was that, you know, I was trying to, I guess it was probably to do with the BBSing.
It was for the expander, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the expander came up. And I was talking about getting the system online, and the expander was a way, because the cartridge slot on the Coker 3 is sort of, I mean, it's a cartridge slot, but also it has the ability to sort of work as a a general bus. There was a device called the multi-pack interface that was released by Radio Shack Tandy, and it would plug in to the, you know, Color Computer, Color Computer 2, Color Computer 3. And I think I indicated that it was incompatible with the Cocoa 3, that it only worked on the Cocoa 2. And he wrote in and mentioned that, yeah, so he pointed out that there are some small electronic modifications that that do need to be made by Radio Shack. And I think it was a simple process. You take it in, and that allowed the multipack interface to work on the Color Computer 3. I was mistaken in indicating that it was a you know, specific to the Cocoa 2. So that's good to clarify. And he pointed to a system. It's sort of a, you know, Tandy sold these things, and of course they haven't been made for a long time, and they're huge. It's a massive four slot device, four cartridge slot device that you know, has, it's about twice the size that it appears it would need to be based on whatever logic and power supplies are in there. But anyway, if you wanted to, you know, plug in a if you wanted to use a floppy drive and say an audio enhancement device and say a real serial port simultaneously, you'd have to get one of these because there was no other way to connect them. It's nice that the capability exists, but it's kind of hard to get your hands on one of these, and also, you know, harder still to modify the you know, the system to run on the more popular Cocoa 3, which is the most powerful unit that you might come across in the series. Well, anyway, there's a device called a Mini MPI that he points to, and it's the Mini Multipack interface. And what it is basically, there's been a board created that does the same thing as the multipack interface that Tandy made, except it is using you know, a very small chipset FPGA. I think there's a two slot version, and I think there's a three slot version. On the webpage, I'm scrolling through and seeing the two slot version. I actually, as it turns out, whether or not I mentioned it, this is the one that I own. It's the two slot Mini MPI. So I can, you know, vouch for the fact that, you know, you plug it in, you switch between items in software. There's a sort of a soft switch, and I've been wrangling with trying to get, there's a little bit of a, I don't think it has anything to do with the Mini MPI. I just think that I don't know the Cocoa scene as well as some others, and so I'm trying to get things configured so that I can get, you know, 9600 baud, you know, BBSing via the Telnet bridge, Wi-Fi bridge on this system. But that's not anything to do with a failing of this device. But anyway, they're not expensive. I think they were, I believe it was, I'm actually looking for the price. I don't know if anyone sees the price. It was not particularly dear, and it came quickly, and it's a lot easier to find and way less desk space than a Tandy multipack interface. So I think that's a good option if you've got a, you know, if you've got a color computer and you're trying to do something a little more with it. That's a good way to go, and I certainly would point people to it.
Cool.
All right. Mm-hmm. And I think there was one other item. Todd wrote in, and he was referring to, there was earlier, I think it was, whether it was at least two shows ago, I was not on the last show, where we talked about, there was some video, a Mac 512K enhanced system. Someone was playing with getting video output. Josh is the fellow's name, Josh Stein. And there's been an update to the progress on this. And here, what he's doing is, there's a video. Those watching the stream are seeing this. It's basically, he switched to a Mac Plus, which has it has a SCSI port, although it's actually a little bit hairier than SCSI. It came out a little bit before the SCSI protocol was nailed down, which is something that gave me weeks of fun when trying to find a modern compatible drive to attach to it. So I'll give it an air quote SCSI. But Mac Plus with its SCSI port is being demonstrated in this tweet from Josh, where he's got it outputting video through the SCSI port going into a Raspberry Pi that has a SCSI adapter that plugs into the GPIO port, and it is rendering that video to a small, you know, a modern LCD. And it's interesting, when you think of SCSI, you're not typically thinking of, sending video out through there. But there is other devices that have non-traditional uses as well. And I'm actually running through for the video watchers. There's the page for the Raspberry Pi-based SCSI device emulator called, how would you pronounce that? Is it RAW SCSI or RA SCSI? I'm not sure. I guess Raspberry SCSI. So yeah, it's Raspberry Pi SCSI adapter, and it lets them interface it to the Mac Plus. Here they're talking about one of the big targets for this project was the Sharp X68000, which is a Japanese system that's a big Motorola 68K based sort of game system, holy grail of gaming in a certain period. But of course it'll interface to other SCSI systems, and that's what is going on here. I actually have and I think this is much more common, a Ethernet adapter on my Mac Plus. It's the Asante EN/SC adapter. And Paul, I'm guessing you probably have one of these too. Am I correct?
Somewhere I have. Yeah. I mean, I think I do. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so that was common. And I saw it a lot of friends in different colleges. That was kind of a standard config for people that were using various Macs, was getting wired into the college LAN with this little box, and it works quite well. It's just Ethernet through SCSI. And I'm actually, Todd sent a link in that email to wrap this up to a device that existed. And I remember ads for this, and it seemed very cool. It's called the SCSI Graph and SCSI Graph 2. And what these are is basically it's the same sort of thing that's happening, with the Raspberry Pi. It's, with some sort of software, it's channeling, quick draw or just whatever the protocol they're grabbing from the Mac, sending it out. And then basically it's a video card on the end of a SCSI cable, and it's doing some translation. And so here you can add a color RGB monitor. It's shown with like the Apple 13-inch Mac RGB monitor you'd see on the Mac 2 being used with a black and white, Mac portable. So this sort of thing has happened before. What I'm not sure of is the software. I'm doubting that the exact same software is being used. The SCSI Graph software is being used to send the data out to the Raspberry Pi, but there must be some sort of a software side of it. I don't have the details on that, but anyway, it's an interesting project, and also interesting to note that this kind of thing did happen back in the day, and I'm sure a lot of people weren't aware. It's pretty obscure. So
I can add, we have one brand new piece of feedback from Brandon, who says, "What a coincidence! I'm setting up a new to me." And then one of these things on a Quadra 700 at this very moment. You called it a RAW SCSI, yeah. I guess, for Raspberry Pi. I was wondering if it maybe should be RAW SEXY, yeah. Though, because I think there was at least, was there not some sort of a push to try to pronounce that as SEXY, SCSI, and eventually lost to the SCSI pronunciation?
I
think so.
I honestly have no memory of that. RAW SEXY.
I think I'd heard that.
Yeah. It's kind of not surprising that it went the way it went.
It didn't take off.
But
yeah. Anyway,
so
just like my perpetual push to pronounce SQL as squeal never seems to go anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I went full in. I focused all of my powers on, on evangelizing correct pronunciation of GIF. So I didn't have any resources or bandwidth left for these other pronunciation issues. So, yeah,
we had one more bit of feedback also. Stan says that he checked and all the mini MPIs are sold out currently.
Oh, okay. Well, so sadly, with a lot of things, and this does disappoint me to see people buying, handfuls of these devices and then selling them on eBay for, whatever. Now, sometimes that's how the actual seller does it. But also there are times when clearly, it's twice the price and it's new, so that if you want to pay for it, then I'm sure you can find it. If the legit creator is using eBay as an outlet, then I apologize if there's confusion, mm-hmm. but I would look on eBay.
I think it's kind of interesting that our hobby has advanced to the point where people could buy things up and then scalp them. on eBay.
Yes, kind of, we've made it.
You know, you're arrived when.
Yeah, yeah.
When the scalpers come for your things.
I mean, it's certainly grown. I mean, you have. I don't know if it's, you know, the FPGA and the compilers, the chains that we talked about a little while ago, but it's pretty nice to see that, as far as I can tell, it's definitely on the grow, on the grow, if that's a phrase. I don't know.
It is now.
On the grow.
We are trendsetters.
Excellent. Matt, also in our chat, has confirmed that Shugart were pushing for this SCSI to be pronounced sexy, to follow on from sassy, S-A-S-I.
Sassy. I remember sassy. Yes. Okay.
Mainly I know of – what I know about sassy is it's not quite scuzzy. You know, that like everything right. I want to do, it almost works, but not quite.
Yeah. I think if I'm not mistaken, I think that's – well – I feel like I remember that the Atari or some Atari ST had a sassy port, but I could be wrong. That's the only place I recall encountering that term. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's see. So, it turns out that I actually don't have all that much feedback to speak about here. Though we had a couple of posts on the Facebook group. Kennet Classic posted something, an image of the SDS 420, which had, I read this all the time, and I don't actually know how to pronounce it, but I would say Persei, the drive manufacturer. Does that sound right? Or is it Persky? I don't know.
It's Persexy.
Okay. Forgive.
Wait, how do you spell it?
P-E-R-S-C-I. They're like a well-known manufacturer of old, particularly 8-inch type drives. But it never occurred to me that I didn't know how to pronounce that until just this very moment. But anyway, there's a Kennet Classic posted an image of this. It's an SDS 420. It has a 6502 CPU and these 8-inch drives, and just sort of getting it up and running. So if you wanted to see an image of that, maybe I'll just say one additional thing about the Mac Plus video thing. I think what we were talking about before, where that came up, was actually this is the same person who was doing the System 6 C programming. So,
right.
So it wasn't, that was, the video thing is like a new edition on that, but it's the same person and the same basic project.
Right. Because first he just had a camera pointed at his Mac, right? And this is an improved way to get the video out.
And it is interesting. I think of Macs as being very insulated video wise. I mean, like it wasn't until, you know, a later Gumdrop iMacs that you actually had like a VGA port you could use. Right. So otherwise you had to use whatever the sort of special Mac video plugs. So.
Hmm. Well, with that then, I guess we can move into the items of interest. And we were talking about the Usenet news groups earlier, Blake. So it sounds like there's been some archaeology there.
It's interesting. There is. So the Usenet, for those that may not be familiar with it, it's not unlike a bulletin board system. It's a threaded one of the internet's early sort of hot apps, one might say. It was established in 1980. It is a decentralized, threaded, sort of a message, systems. Messages are stored sequentially. They are sent in packets from one server to another. There's no central place. There's not unlike an internet forum, you don't log into the server and you're typing and then save and then you come back to it later. So it was distributed and, depending on where you were, you might at a given point in time have different, you know, they were up to date to different degrees as far as the relays, that, you know, shared the feeds. Anyway, I spent a great deal of time in college on the Usenet, you know, researching this and that. I mean, generally in the computer topics, there were all types of topics were really represented. But anyway, there were, you know, hundreds of millions of posts that existed over the years, you know, since it began in 1980. And the situation we're talking about today is there's, and I hope I'm not pronouncing his name wrong, Joseph Jerosiak. Apparently he has created what is called the Usenet Archive, and he set up a website which has a simple search. He was able to, and there are links to posts about this that we'll post in the show notes. And he was able to get hold of a number of archive tapes that had been stored. I think initially it was 141, 144 tapes. And anyway, he set these up on his website. Currently, there are 2.1 million Usenet posts on his site. And they're in the process of adding 317 million additional Usenet posts spread over 10,000 different Usenet groups. And in the future, he believes that there will be they'll be able to get somewhat over a billion items on the system. You have it's a simple, you know, very Spartan search console, and it lets you the way the Usenet was organized, there would be different headers and there were tiers. Like you might, it's what he has listed are some of the top tiers. There's Alt, Comp, Humanities, Microsoft, MIS. So for instance, as I'm, you know, clicking through here, if you would click on Comp, then under Comp, which is computer related, you would find alphabetically the next heading. So it was comp dot something dot something dot something. And if you jump, just as an example, here, what I'm looking at is comp.lang.java. So you click on that, and then what you've got through his Usenet archive site is a listing. And here are some, the dates for what I happen to have pulled up, end of 2011. They start, we're going back to 2005. I'm just scrolling through, you know, seeing 2004, and you can go on and on and on. As I said, he has about 2.1 million right now. Well, actually, it's probably somewhat higher because the 317 million has been in process for some time. And if you click on one of the titles, you actually see the threaded message. You know, a person did an original post, someone responded. If there's quote text, just basically like a, you know, sort of a, it's actually more like a BBS as far as its presentation, because it was all textual. There weren't a lot of features beyond reply, maybe quote. But this records a great deal of history. And I think a lot of, again, I followed the computer, the comp dot, you know, areas mainly. But I remember there were a whole lot of, you know, applications, hardware devices, systems that were, that sort of evolved based on feedback and input, you know, over the course of years in some of these threads. I certainly used these, you know, a decade ago, 15 years ago, to figure out how to, I recall using the Usenet to, you know, get my next station online, because I, you know, didn't have the proper documentation to, you know, tie to a get a dynamic IP address. So very useful stuff. I personally want to take some time and dig through and see if I can find some of my old posts. And that's kind of a fun way you can go, because your name, you know, your name, your SIG, that kind of thing, your signature would be in there. And I think there's some good opportunity for digging through and kind of getting a walk down memory lane. But it's interesting. There's and then there's another, I think Tony wrote in with another article, and we'll link that. And basically it talks about, it's the same effort, but it's going through, it goes into the details of, you know, the more of a technical side of converting from the tapes to a Postgres SQL database and getting that online. So we'll provide that link as well. But they're, you know, two sides of the same coin. But it's quite an effort. And, you know, I know right now a lot of the Usenet is archived on Google, has, you know, Google Groups, which sort of took over the Usenet, but I think a lot of people, you know, once Google acquired that, you know, I've used it to look back, trying to find some information about obscure things that I can't find elsewhere. But I think some people still use it in that capacity, but I think a lot of people kind of walked away, if I'm not wrong. And you guys, I would be curious to hear what the other folks here would think about that. Did Google's acquisition, did that sort of mark the end of it as far as you're concerned? Or
I feel like that certainly changed how I was using it. Like,
yeah.
I remember I was using Usenet mostly in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And at some point, and my experience was that it was always very transient. There was kind of like, mm-hmm. it was kind of like a first in, first out. Oh, every yeah. place that hosted Usenet stuff dedicated a certain amount of disk space to it, and then old posts would just disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
depending on, you know, whether you're connecting through an employer or through a university or whatever it was, you would have a different amount of things. And I remember at some point, this company popped up called Deja News that said,
yes.
oh,
yes.
we've just been archiving a ton of this, and we have many, many years of Usenet. And that was like a revelation. And then Google bought that, and that's what became Google Groups. But nowadays, like, Google Groups seems to be more like mailing lists.
Yeah.
And so like I don't really know if Google Groups is still connected to like Usenet, because Usenet still exists. The yeah. technology still exists
sure.
for pushing messages around. I don't know how that ties into Google Groups, if it does
right.
at all.
Yeah, I think I used Deja News, and I mean, I'm trying to remember the name of the service. There was a service that oftentimes it was the case that, okay, you'd get your, and this is, I guess, before the days of, you know, Verizon, Fios, and then, you know, Xfinity. Now we have these big tier, when it was a little more, you know, smaller, you had more choices. ISPs would bundle a certain amount of Usenet accessibility. Mm-hmm. It would allow you this much. You can access, you know, 8 million, you know, however many posts per month. You know, part of the Usenet is binary. Like the files would be split, and massive amounts of data, like people were distributing, you know, like high definition movie rips and things like that. Sadly, it certainly had a reputation of, I think, evading international law with like things like, you know, child pornography. I mean, that was a big piece of it, from what I understood, as far as like news stories about, you know, countries working together to try to, you know, handle this problem where there was no consistent law about, you know, controlling or monitoring data. It's been a great deal of time since, I mean, I remember I downloaded a number of high def, you know, movies, things like that. But it's been at least 10 years since I've even looked at the what the binary situation is there. But yeah, I used it in college constantly. And, but yeah, not since, certainly not since Google acquired it. I haven't used it in any meaningful way.
I was actually kind of surprised. I used the news groups quite a bit in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. I had a internet account through ISP called Netcom. And with Netcom, one of the things, like you were saying, the ISPs would sometimes bundle the news
yeah.
groups with the ISP service. And Netcom was one of those. So, one of the things that surprised me, though, was with all of these providers who had news group replicas with whatever their particular take was on retention of the messages, that there could be millions of messages that somehow wound up lost in the ether, that never got stored anywhere and aren't online anymore. I didn't actually know that situation existed. And then when this article came out with restoring all these messages from tape and that there were millions more to go, I thought, wow, how is it that we lost all those to begin with? Especially with Google Groups having taken over a big chunk of the news groups, I had just kind of assumed that all of the conversations all the way back to the beginning of Usenet mm-hmm. were archived somewhere. But I guess they were in danger of being lost, and thank goodness for this effort, you know, because like you said, there's a lot of computing history. There's a lot of just social history out there. I remember in the late 80s, I had a friend who had access to the newsgroups, and it's where we would get all of our Star Trek rumors. We even had a saying back then, you know, when we'd read a rumor or something from an unsubstantiated source, we'd say, well, it's on the internet, it must be true. And like you say, there were a hierarchy of all sorts of things, not just technology. So fascinating that these things almost got lost.
I know it had been archived by a number of different groups and, you know, some for profit, Deja News, you know, I paid some, I'm trying to recall the name of it, because at one point I wanted binary access because like HD TV had just become a thing. So I wanted to be able to show off my TV. Nothing was HD on cable, you know, so I was like, okay, I'm going to pay for this binary access, and I can't remember the name of the company, or even the name of this magical Mac-based client that would work wonders at, you know, reassembling things automatically. I note here, as part of this story, it looks like, you know, specifically UT Zoo Net News Archive is the tape-based archive we're talking about here, and it was apparently Henry Spencer was the gentleman's name from the University of Toronto Department of Zoology, and he was backing them up on magnetic tape for years, and apparently it was at a very great expense. And it looks like that's where I'm getting the 141 mentioned earlier, 141 magnetic tapes. So that's where this, at least the first batch of these, are coming from, and I'm not sure if that will, you know, constitute the, you know, 1 billion that's forecast to land on this site or not. But certainly there's archives spread all over the place, you know, how to perhaps finding a way to consolidate and merge those in a meaningful way is part of this plan. But it's certainly nice to, it would be nice to think that there's a real, you know, a staying archive that covers the vast majority of what was out there, because, you know, there's a lot of information there. Staggering amount.
I know I'm out there asking some questions about checkpoint firewalls, a couple of other things in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
So,
like
you say, it'd be fun to see if we can find our own posts.
It definitely does, you know, it, so first of all, I, you know, like Jack, I used it, like all of us, I suppose I used it a fair amount in the early 90s. I tended to use it a little bit more for not so much the tech stuff. I mean, there was some tech stuff, but I remember spending a lot of time on Alt TV Twin Peaks. That was the one that I was in a lot. I also did not realize that Google didn't have all this stuff. I mean, like, because it did, you know, I can go back and find my little posts in Alt TV Twin Peaks, you know, easily enough. But I guess there was a fairly big split even back then between, you know, the sort of binary use and the text use and all the different, you know, carriers or, you know, the people that, you know, so I guess basically that you could pay people to access Usenet through, and the more the people you paid more to would give you access to like the binary groups, and usually the things that you had access to through your cable provider would be only text and sometimes a few like really local things, you know, that there would be like your city's news group or whatever. But CompSys Apple II is still, I mean, like, that's still a active going concern, you know, people are posting there all the time.
The TI-99 group, however it's formulated, I believe that's still active. And I think, as far, you're right, the binaries, it was like you didn't get binary access, at least not maybe at the very beginning when you're the modem, you know, a phone modem is what kept you from, you know, hogging all their bandwidth downloading, you know, binaries. But the binary data surely is not, I would think, is not archived. Like, why would someone really archive? Because the stuff, the amount of data that moved through there was immense. I can't imagine that that would be archived. And I don't know how much of a loss that is, because, you know, I don't think people had felt that the video and the big media areas were, you know, they just, it flowed through so fast that I don't think anyone thought, oh, I'm going to go back in 6 months and I'll go ahead and download that again, because it would be long gone.
That's more ephemeral kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That certainly was.
And that's probably.
That was certainly the way it was treated. And that's the way it was sort of early on. I think the binary stuff really was, that's just convention. I mean, you know, that it was a text messaging thing, but people realized that if you posted 500 messages with, you know, some error correction, that you could actually get a whole binary file across. So,
yeah.
But I think it's still even today, you know, it's still just text. And you know, it's still, you know, there are, you can pay people. GigaNews is the people I pay, you know, for you know, long-term binary retention. So
that's it. GigaNews is who I pay. GigaNews is who I used to pay a monthly when I was pulling down a lot of demonstrative high HD stuff. Yeah, GigaNews, and it's been a great deal of time since.
Yeah.
I had them.
But to answer the question you asked, I use comp.sys.cbm today. Nice. I got my news story from them.
Very cool.
Really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. It's definitely still active. It always seems like it's sort of surprising and magical to me that it even still works, because I mean, like, it basically is just a massive distribution system. And when we are really talking about, like, you know, a lot of binary video at this point, that is still being massively distributed somehow, for, you know, like, someone's supporting that, you know. And before, it used to be just universities or whatever, you know, companies or whatever, just having mirrors of text. But you know, as it becomes a distribution for binary stuff, it does put a lot of weight on it. So there, as you mentioned, a magical app, the one that I liked the most, sort of in the early days. I mean, there's stuff that you can use now. But the thing that I liked the most was Panax Unison. And that might be one of the ones that you could have been thinking about.
I think I now know the name. It had an Egyptian figure, and I think it was Thoth. That was the one that had Thoth. I think it wouldn't work. Like, when OS 10 came, it needed the classic environment, but it was well worth running. I mean, it would basically, it would look at the noisiest and most out of sequence series of you know, split binaries that no normal person would be able to put together in a sequence and feed to a decoder, and it would figure it out. It was amazing. And then I remember there was the developer stopped supporting it, and you needed to pay to registration to use it. And people were trying to give this guy money, saying, please give me a key. But that was it. There was no more key. And people were saying, I'll pay you five times the amount. Can I please just get a key to use this again? And I don't know whatever happened, if it got picked up again, but that's what it was. That was it. So,
yeah, I remember that. I can remember the icon. I remember thinking that it was sort of like on the Eudora model of, like, you know, the way the sort of app worked. It kind of reminded me of Eudora.
Yeah. Yeah, the interface was, yeah.
But
strange.
Unison was great. Like, Unison also, like, it was a step into the modern era.
I did use Unison
from that. But Unison is also I think you can still download it from Panax, but they no longer develop it.
Unison is the last one I ever used. It's been probably 10 years since I've tried to decode a binary or had access to binaries on Usenet. So, but yep,
Unison. The way things work currently, generally, is there's a kind of a description file called NZB that sort of, like, packages all that stuff together. So it says, like, these are the 900 messages that constitute this file. So, you know, there's actually a number of ways that currently you just get this sort of manifest file, and it basically, you know, your little program will go fetch those messages and assemble it for you. And Unison is actually probably pretty good for reading text. I mean, like, it's good for actually, like, interacting with a text group. It's still pretty good.
Sure.
But I do, so, and to get back to the actual topic, I do kind of wonder whether, like, how much non-overlap there is with what Google has on these tapes.
I wonder if it seems like they're talking about, you know, how long this has been archived. And again, there's several dates, but I wonder if the situation is that these go back farther. I wonder if the situation is that these are closer to the 1980 start, because I could see Google having less interest as not being, you know, their goal not being like as a complete, you know, technology or just information archival. They're also trying to provide it as a service. Maybe that's what it is. I'd like to hear, I'm sure we'll hear more about it as it goes on. And, but it's nice that this is happening.
I'm sitting here trying to remember what newsreader I used to use on Next Step in the 90s. And I can't
Oh remember. Yes, that's right. That I did. there was one though. I mean, like that was definitely like one of the main places I used Usenet initially was on one of those, you know, nice grayscale screens.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of looked like the mail right. app, I remember.
I wish I could think of the CLI one that I used to use. Like on the shell yeah. account?
Oh, there was
I
one.
I know I used one also. And I can't
oh,
remember what it was called.
Yes. Well, it was like GNUS or something like that. No, NN something. So,
NNCP?
It might have been just NN, actually.
NN.
Oh, that might have been it. NetNews.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds familiar. Wow.
And it's quite possible that our messaging technologies are better today. I'm not sure that it was better then. It was interesting then, but.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. There was a Next Step news newsreader called NewsGrazer. I remember that.
Yeah, I don't think I had Next Step for Intel at the time, but I didn't have an app for Usenet. I was using command line. I was using I can't remember what we were using on the command line in the terminal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know.
I guess, you know, being in danger of one of those, whoa, it was better back then, get off my lawn kind of things. But one thing that I did appreciate about the news groups were it wasn't as distracting as a lot of things that you look at today, because it wasn't like a Las Vegas sort of circus. You know, you were just yeah. looking at text. And so it was, you know, a pretty high or low, depending on how you do the math, signal to noise ratio on those.
Yeah, I think it was sort of self-selecting as well. I mean, it had a barrier to entry. You know, it wasn't like
right.
you had to know what it was. It's kind of like sort of like IRC today, although IRC is a little wider. People didn't just bumble into the Usenet. You know, they weren't just here's news groups. Of course, no, you had to kind of know what you were doing, and that made it more of a yeah.
And because it wasn't full of links, it wasn't the web. So it wasn't like today you can just go to a website and click, click, click your whole day. Like there's always something more to go to. Usenet would like, it was, you know, kind of predated the common use of URLs for things. So it's like
yep.
you would read something and, you know, sometimes they might call out to, you know, here's something on an FTP site. But still then it was not, you didn't click on that. You would copy that link and or type it in somewhere else, do something else. So it was like, yeah, you didn't really sort of like jump through 20 things because you saw one thing.
Right.
Right.
It was focused. It was way more focused, I think.
And I found out about it through one of my first Dummies books. You remember the Dummies books?
Oh, yeah.
So there was one that was real early on, Internet for Dummies. So that book let you know about things like IRC, the news groups, the web, a couple of other technologies out there that were really, you know, early on in the game. And told you some of the command line interfaces or other interfaces that you could use to access. Oh, Gopher. Gopher was on there too.
Oh, yes. I remember Gopher.
Yeah. Archie.
All right. Well, shall we move on?
Yeah. I'm just thinking that it's quite possible that it's going to be like the second decade is going to end by the time this episode is finished.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'll try and keep mine short, but I'm really happy because, you know, earlier we were talking about the fact that you've got these old computers, but because the knowledge has increased over time and some of the cross development tools have gotten better, that we're doing things with these old systems that you wouldn't have thought possible back then. And I think my news item is kind of one of those. It's a new game. And it's for the Commodore 128. And I, you know, my radar kind of powers up anytime I see something for the Commodore 128, because I don't think it gets enough love in the native 128 mode. And this game is called Volley for Two. It's like a computer volleyball game with some really cute graphical characters. and all the graphics look nice in the game. And it does something that's pretty rare on the Commodore 128. The 128 can drive two screens at once, a 40-column screen and an 80-column screen. And not a lot of people actually wrote software that takes advantage of that, but this game does, in that you've got the game going on the 40-column screen, and it can do an extended scoreboard on the 80-column screen. So that's fun.
Oh, nice. That's
looked cool. Like it had some fun animations. The music was great. And here's one other kicker. They had both an NTSC and a PAL support for this, which is pretty cool, because a lot of the 8-bit, a lot of the things that come out for the 8-bits these days are coming out of Europe, other places that are in PAL land. And it's always fun to have something that supports both of the video standards so that we can enjoy it here with our NTSC machines in the States. And it's just fun that there's new software coming out for these guys all the time.
Yeah, neat.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to say this sort of side-on view of simplistic volleyball. I remember having a very, very similar game to this on the Amiga in about 1990, 91. And this version for the Commodore 128 looks way better. Amiga game that I had, I don't think it had any kind of background graphics. It was very sort of plain. It was two players, a wall in the middle, and a ball you hit back and forth. This looks much nicer.
And something like this with really simple gameplay, sometimes these can be some of the most fun games.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember having a blast playing this volleyball game on the Amiga. The article says it's based off a DOS game called Volleyball. I assume that's the same as the Amiga game that I had.
Ah.
Because I'm looking at the gameplay, and it looks very, very similar. Fun bouncing around, and your little players are also round, ball-ish humans, or ball-ish things.
Creatures of some sort. Yeah, they look cute. Yep. Look like it'd be fun to play with your children, too. In fact, nice. I think the reviewer did do that on Vintage is the New Old, if I remember right.
Okay.
I think for the video, the offspring were enlisted.
Cool.
So, Paul, what have you got on stacked RAM modules?
Yes. Okay. I have. Let's see. I'll move my shared screen over here. This is another thing from Ken Shiroff's blog. And I just came across this. I thought it was kind of interesting. And it's quite possible that the thing that really caught my attention is the Apple III in the title there. But it's just sort of talking about fabrication of RAM chips. And he was sort of making the point, I guess, along the way there that CPUs get a lot of the attention in discussion of sort of vintage computing and stuff, but RAM actually had a pretty big impact because there's a lot of effort put into trying to sort of make RAM like small enough to fit. I mean, like that, like
make
he
it
has
smaller,
pictures.
Make it faster. Yeah.
Right. He has pictures of somewhere down here of like, big computer rooms with core memory spread out, across the room and that sort of thing, and getting down to tape decks and things like that. But so that what this actual article is about these RAM chips. And I honestly, I never thought anything of these. I see these. They exist in the Apple III. But I didn't even know what they were. But essentially what they are is two 16 kilobit. I don't know. I'm not sure what the K is marking. It probably is bit, actually. But it's sort of two 16K things mounted on a single like dual inline, whatever P stands for, thing. So that basically in the space that you would put a 16K chip, you have two 16Ks. Mostek was coming up with a way to basically just like fit more memory in a smaller space. And that was what this was. So, and it's basically just two 16K things on a single, mounting thing. And, so if you look down the article, they sort of show these things on an Apple III memory card. So the Apple III had this like daughter board card where all the memory went. And it was that was basically just because they were trying to cram all the stuff into this like small space. And in fact, actually, there's a note here that mentions that the case was designed before the computer, in a way, like before the all the pieces were, so that the board had to kind of like take whatever space it was given to try to make it fit. And so that in order to actually get, you know, as much memory as they wanted to have on this, they had one of the rows of RAM chips was actually sort of designated for these 4332s that. Package, okay, dual inline package is what the P stands for, but anyway, the in DIP that is, but so you know I'd seen these chips on Apple III boards, and you know I just sort of assumed it was just, you know, one manufacturer's style for making these, but apparently this was actually sort of an innovation, and the Apple III was going to be the main you know, like one of the larger customers for these chips. So, and of course, then the Apple III kind of imploded or whatever. So that, you know, I don't think, you know, I think basically this was relatively short-lived because there were other form factors for, you know, memory moved on after this. But anyway, I thought it was interesting. It wasn't even something I knew was a thing to think about. You know, I just had assumed it was just some weird looking chip, but there actually is something functionally different about it. It is a way of taking two 16s and smashing them together in one place.
So, nice.
Yeah.
These look pretty cool too.
Yeah. So if you open your Apple III, you can see them. Actually, you have to open it pretty seriously, because to actually get at the board is it's relatively hidden away.
You know, it seems like
cool.
One of the CPU cards, maybe more than one, that I have for the PDP-11, the QBus cards, have the same sort of style, where there's multiple dies on a single dual inline form factor. And I don't know, I just think it looks pretty cool. Mm-hmm. There's probably inefficiencies involved with it and that kind of thing, but it looks neat. Well, we got one more. Blake, I think you should talk about this. Amiga's 35. Okay. Happy birthday, Amiga.
Yes. This year is the Amiga's 35th birthday. It actually was in July, July 23rd of 1985. It was unveiled at the Lincoln Center in New York, and famously Andy Warhol took the stage and painted with the mouse various portraits of Debbie Harry, Blondie, and there were other demonstrations of the system. And that was, I suppose, the official release or launch. But it was a number of months before you could get one. And it occurred to me, looking at the calendar, I guess this past week, that it was on the 21st of October, which is just behind us. I think that was a few days prior to my realizing this, that's when I purchased my first Amiga, and that was the first Amiga that's available. And so I wrote a blog post about it, and it's, you know, kind of a personal reminiscence, little meandering in its conveyance. But I talk about my first Amiga. It was an Amiga 1000. We just called it the Amiga, even though it was actually the Amiga 1000. You didn't really notice the 1000 until the 500 and the 2000 came out in 1987. But at any rate, one of the things that I, you know, found interesting was, you know, it was advertised in the local newspaper. I remember seeing ads for it. I mean, I became aware of it first with, you know, there were a few little small mentions, AP news items, new machine from Commodore, and it didn't really register. But I got this issue of Personal Computing magazine off the shelf in the bookstore, and it really told the tale of what the Amiga was, and it was pretty astonishing. And this was before it was released, of course. And so I was, you know, anticipating it. I remember carrying that magazine around a lot. And, you know, I was ready to get it. My memory gets hazy. Like, I'm not going to, you know, tell the whole blog post here. But I remember I guess it was because it was some months. It was like summer when I read about it. And it wasn't until October, you know that I I mentioned that I got one. A few months passed. I had been trying to sell my 2C just to get an original Mac, and I was getting Macworld in the mail, you know. And so I guess for whatever reason, I decided, okay, well, the Amiga's cool, but I'm still going to get that Mac, and I did. And about a week after I got the Mac home, I went in to buy floppy disks at a different store, and there was an Amiga on the desk. And it turns out, and I've, you know, looking at, I actually spent some time looking back at old archives of newspapers that I pay to have access to, which kind of helps with some of my blog posts. I see ads for the system leading up to its availability. But anyway, there it was. It turns out they were the first dealer to have it, certainly in the state I live, Virginia, and possibly, you know, a few other states south. There were not a lot of Amigas on sale all over the place in America at that time. So it was like some months after I saw it, or maybe at least a month after I saw it demoed, we ended up taking the Mac back, putting money down, and you know, I was going to get this Amiga. We got a call, and they got two units in, you know, to sell other than the demo version. And I got the first one, and it turns out, looking at everything I have available to me, it is the first Amiga that was sold in Virginia and one of the first on the East Coast. So I got in early, I guess, which is something sort of a point of pride for me. So anyway, I give a little more information, actually a lot more information about the early days of the Amiga, reactions. You know, people, no one really knew what to make of it. Developers had a hard time determining what to make of it because of its graphics and sound. It was a game machine. But yet it, you know, had more meat in its hardware than a $6,000 AT did, PCAT. So anyway, I talk about my experiences with it early on, and I've gotten, you know, it's gotten some nice number of comments or people that have had the same, you know, very similar experiences, and you know, there's just a variety of things. So anyway, if it's 35 years. More about, I guess, 35 years since I got my Amiga, which, you know, is the same year as its birthday. So it's you may find it an interesting read, but it's a little lengthy, but it was fun to put together. So happy birthday, Amiga, 35 years.
Nice. Sweet.
Yep. And that's over at Byte Cellar. We'll put the link notes.
Well, it doesn't look a day over 25. And actually, I think, in some senses, that's true, because when the Amiga first came out, a lot of people mentioned the multitasking, preemptive operating system, and the graphics and sound were maybe a decade ahead of its time.
Yeah, I still have, you know, I talked about that early one, and I sold the early one, but I wanted to point out that I still have I've reacquired an Amiga 1000 and have expanded it pretty heavily, and I use it several times a week. It's one of my main go-tos for BBSing, and so even today, I think it's a great machine.
Awesome.
Nice.
All right, well, that does it for the news, and now a word from our sponsor.
The average school child hasn't really changed much over the years. But school has. The computer has arrived. Under a government scheme, schools all over Britain are introducing microcomputers, and they're choosing one in particular, made by Acorn. As a result, the language it uses, called BBC Basic, has become the acknowledged computer language for schools. And now parents can catch up. For Acorn have produced a micro for the home that also uses BBC Basic. It's called the Electron. It's powerful, it's versatile, and it's only £199. So now your children can teach you all they know. The Acorn Electron can be found at larger WH Smiths or your local Acorn dealer. Just call 200-0200 for your nearest stockist.
And we're back.
Very nice.
So I was trying to find a gift idea for this episode. And I thought to myself, self, what sort of things do you tend to see or use on a daily basis that bring you joy? And I thought one of the things that I like are stickers, because I litter up the lid of my laptop with stickers. It's always fun to pick them up. I got a lot of cool ones from Kansas Fest. So between that and some other things, I've got like a really nerdy laptop. And the other thing that I like are posters. So I went out looking to see if there were some nice posters or prints that you could get. And I found this one. Now, it's Commodore 64. So, okay, I'm a Commodore guy. But I've always liked the look of patents, particularly the illustrations that they do for patents, kind of the artist's rendition of the machine. And I thought this one had some nice angles on it. So to describe it for people who can't actually see it, you can get this print in a variety of sizes and in a variety of finishes. It is the Commodore 64 patent and various angles on the machine. So looking at it front on, looking at it from the right angle, and drawn in that typical patent sketch illustration sort of fashion. The other thing that I like was that you could choose the background color and the background finish that you wanted. There were a couple of them. One of them, I think, is called Aged Parchment, that looked really nice. And so I just thought, and they weren't terribly expensive. My last gift idea, I think, was a little pricey, so I wanted to get something a little more budget conscious this time.
It is interesting how they don't look like the thing ended up looking, really, do they?
That's true too. Yeah, there was some variation from this patent to the ultimate product, huh?
Yeah, looking from, especially from the side angle, you see there's like a,
this is the C,
it's
the,
like super thin at the back, which the C64 is not.
Looks kind of like a C16 or something.
Interesting.
Cool.
It also has a sort of a, almost kind of a woodcut aesthetic to it.
Yeah.
And I think you can find these for varying computers or varying technology things. It turns out these patent prints are kind of a thing, and I didn't know that. So this one's for the Commodore 64, but there are others. I don't know if there are others from this seller, but I saw some others as I was poking around on the internets.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen some for the Apple III as well that I think about sometimes as possibilities. They do look sort of funny, you know, this almost woodcut kind of look.
Right.
So I think, in fact, I do this, I have in the past done this podcast on the Apple III and designed the logo for it. Was, you know, it's called Drop 3 Inches, and that's based on this lore of like, that's how you fix the Apple III is drop it. But but right. I used one of the patent prints for that, you know, like sort of illustrating how it lifts up 3 inches. You know, like I put the little like engineering, you know, 3 inches arrows and stuff.
The arc.
It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, because we actually had one at the computer shop that I worked at, but it never failed. Our floor model never failed. So I never had the opportunity to pick it up and drop it, because I think that would have been one of the best fixes ever. Mm-hmm. But
I think, actually, just to dovetail into the Usenet conversation, I had a week after I got my Atari 520 ST, the first of several I've had, it stopped working. And I went on from the campus computer lab to the Usenet and asked what to do. And someone said, drop it 5 inches. They said 5. Mm-hmm. I dropped it, and it worked solidly from then on. So,
wow. Cool.
Yeah. It's the video. I think it had a glue chip that was, you know, one of the square ones that would, you know, kind of raise up out of that socket.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to do some math, right? Acceleration of gravity, 9.8 meters per second squared.
Yeah, I took his word for it. 5 inches. It seemed high. It seemed kind of high. 3 inches sounds better.
Loud bang, but hey, if it works. Yeah.
Of course, the Apple III weighs about 114 pounds, right? Unlike the Atari ST.
Yes, it's harder to lift it higher.
Uh-huh. Right.
So you can spend money on a poster, or you could spend money on eBay. Or both. So why don't we talk about eBay first? Blake, you have some items here.
Okay, yeah, just quickly to go through. Okay, so the first item is a Just I had like posters from early industry, big hardware, and I found three. It's a set of $20 current bid, 5 days on this auction. A set of three very large vintage Cray Research posters. One for the Cray YMP EL, the YMP C90, and the MPGS. And you know, it's very futuristic looking. There's 3D renderings of the space shuttle, modern things like that. And you know, it's pretty kind of Lawnmower Man looking aesthetics to, you know, I guess Cray's notion of what a server room could look like is a little more sci-fi than I think what you typically found, but they're pretty cool. I like these kind of things. I have some SGI, you know, posters like this, and I think maybe some Sun ones that are, you know, a little bit over the top like these. So that's, it looks like it's $20, or actually it's free. I'm going to have to say this limits the audience. Ships to local pickup only. So, sorry, you have to live in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and go get it. Mm-hmm. That little detail there, I guess, makes it, that means I won't be ordering it. So,
wait, is this the first three very large vintage Cray Research? Because I see shipping to United States. And it has a shipping price. Are we looking at the same option?
Free local pickup, and it says ships to local pickup only. Interesting. For me. So maybe it's to do. I'm in the, you know, the DC area.
Maybe you are blacklisted.
If you're seeing, maybe I am blacklisted. It could not be.
Do not ship to Blake.
Yeah. Well, technically, I'm in Virginia, so I don't know if it could have something to do with.
It'll ship to me though. Yeah, I'm seeing what Earl is saying. Like it'll for a little under $9. I could.
Okay.
Anyway, well, these are cool. I promise.
I didn't need these posters anyway.
I did steal the idea from you. We're on a poster theme, but.
No, that's great minds think alike, but Okay. Well, anyway, my second item, it's actually, I guess, my second and third item. I'll say there's, I was actually one of the machines I had, kind of like that Mac 128K that I was talking about a while ago. One of the machines I've only had for a very short amount of time is the Laser 3000, which was a kind of an Apple II clone from VTech. They still make educational consoles for kids. They made the Laser 128. They made the Apple II clone. They made the Laser, I think it was called the XT, a PC clone. They were behind the Universal Disk Controller for that Central Point Software sold. They've been in and around the Apple area pretty significantly. Well, anyway, the Laser 3000 was a generic sort of CPM-ish machine, but you could put a cartridge into it and it would run Apple II software. I think I had it a week and returned it because it was too bizarre. Anyway, I found two laser units. They always kind of fascinate me because I keep seeing a new laser unit I've never heard from before. This is the Laser 110, and it's about as nondescript as you can get. You know, a little chiclet keyboard, very basic, capabilities. It has a basic language installed, which is apparently rather poor. It's a variation of a system looking into it called the Laser 200. And another unit I'll show is the other auction, which is another laser unit, I guess a little bit higher spec. It's the Laser 310 that I'm sharing right now. The 310 has, it's not a chiclet keyboard, it's a real keyboard, but basically it's the same machine. $31 for this. I didn't even state what the price of the previous was. I'm sorry. But at any rate, that was $100 actually for the 100. But, you know, looking into it, they're basically CPM, they're Z80 machines that are not unlike CPM systems, but apparently they're more specifically TRS-80 Model 1-like. Their architecture is very similar, but they don't run its software. They're sort of like, it's like if you go to a store, I think, and you found like a tin can with a white label that just said beans on it. I think this says computer. You know, I think basically it's like, it's a computer. And there you go. So it's strange. I guess the whole situation of laser machines just seems kind of a strange thing to me because they seem to pop in when they don't actually have an ecosystem. as far as I can tell. But anyway, because these are oddities, in my mind, these are the two little items that wrap up the last of my eBay auctions. I won't be ordering these, but and I doubt I'll be understanding really what they're about any more than I did before we started talking about this.
I could swear that we got my son Joshua a couple of VTech things when he was younger, like educational technology toys. And I didn't even know until probably 2 or 3 years ago, maybe, that they'd had these lines of 8-bit computers.
We will have talked a bit about these computers in terms of the Dick Smith microcomputer, because the VTech, you know, laser computers were rebranded by Dick Smith in Australia. So Michael speaks often about the Dick Smith computers, and these are those same things.
The only clone that I think I'd like to have sometime is one of the Franklin Ace clones. Because we had them at the computer store that I worked at. We had it until the lawsuit. I don't know if I'm remembering that right, but we had them and then we didn't, which was a bummer because people would come in. We had Commodore, we had Atari, we had, you know, a couple other like business brands. People would be like, hey, so we're shopping around for a computer. Do you have Apple? And we would say, no, we don't have the Apple computers. And they get this really distasteful look on their face and just walk out the store. It's like, we have Ataris. They're pretty cool. We have Commodores. You know, they can do this and that. They got the sound and the other. You have Apple? No, we don't have Apple. Well, goodbye then.
And non-zero, non-zero percentage of the Commodores work.
So, and that was
good.
And
some
and
of them will work.
And that was the first day you met Carrington, right? You finally remember meeting Carrington for the first time.
Well, you know, the funny thing was, I mean, the software catalog, of course, was unrivaled for the Apple. But we just had this fledgling hope that if we can get this clone, then maybe people won't run out of the store as we're grabbing their heels, you know, don't go, don't go. But yeah, that didn't work out so well. Oh, well. Yeah, I'd like to have a Franklin, but the other clones don't really interest me a whole bunch. Well, let's see what else we got here. Oh, I've got one. My eBay pick is cheap this week also. My pick is colorful paper for pin feed printers. I remembered this back in the day. People would use it to make posters or that kind of thing. They'd get print shop and they'd get some of this cool neon paper and then they would print something up and it really looked kind of fun. So how much does it cost again? Because again, I'm not seeing this.
It is $12.95. I'll buy it now.
Yeah, for 120 sheets of varying neon colors. And the one thing that I do remember, though, it looked like most of the neon colors on this auction were brighter, which would mean that the black print from your printer would stand off better. But if you got a darker color, then it was black ink on a dark colored paper, and that just didn't work very well. And one of those colors that is in this assortment, I think there's 5 or 6 colors in here. And one of the colors I looked at, I thought, that's if you really actually took it and used it, that's not going to show up very well. But the others would be kind of fun.
It looks like there's a pink and an orange that might be a little rough.
Yeah, and a couple of the others were eye bleed, but...
Right.
Well, I noticed it says the condition for under condition. It's just there's no comment. So we're going to hope that they're not full of pre-printed banners and were folded back and put into the case, given that the condition isn't indicated. So.
Yeah.
Well, they look like they're in plastic. So hopefully.
I'm being silly.
But yeah, it could be.
Yeah. Interestingly, looking at at the lower part of the screen, there's a related sponsored items. And I think this sponsored part means that, you know, somebody paid something to have these be listed down here. But there do seem to be also if you knew what color you wanted, you know, there do seem to be slightly more expensive ones that are just like a single color. too.
Oh, that are just that color? Yeah. Oh, okay, great.
Yeah. I'm not sure that they're all pin feed. They might be, but interesting.
Some are, certainly.
Yeah.
Neat. So that was right. Mine. Okay. What about you, Paul?
Well, I wrote a bunch down, or like I copied a bunch down, and in the time since I did that, some of them have sold already. So, I mean, I guess I picked well. The first one I had, there was I think we may have talked about this a couple of times, but it's an Apple Interactive Television Box. So it's kind of a strange little Apple device that, you know, maybe people, because we talk about it here, will know about. But it is basically like, it's a cable box, basically, but it's got a Mac inside. So it was intended to be used as kind of like an information system. I think they had it in maybe the Disneyland hotels or something like that. There was some place where they kind of beta ran these, and there was somewhere in Europe the two that had them. But they're essentially like a prototype almost at this point, because they weren't really on the market. And I forget exactly what Mac it is that's inside them, but it's it is possible to get these things to start and to run things on them. The thing that has always been difficult is they have sort of a special ROM, and so you have to make sure that you get the ROM that can start your thing. Some of them did actually depend on reaching out to the network to get software. So that network, of course, does not exist. So it could be that what you're winding up with is just sort of like a black pizza box Mac that you can't do anything with. I have one of these, and it basically, when I plug it in and turn it on, it is much like plugging it into like a dead power outlet and turning it on. Like there's no sign of life at all. So, but it looks kind of nice.
Yeah. I've seen these before, you know, it's been talked about on the show, but I've seen a number of these. I have a friend that has one. I've never seen any reports. What you're telling me is something I hadn't heard of them ever doing anything other than just black screen. Like you're saying that people have done things with these.
Yeah, I think the trick was to get the proper like video driver, essentially, I think. And eventually somebody found the software. It's out there. You know, it's been out there for a while that you can sort of boot up System 7 or something like that on it. So it has been – you can do it. And I actually think that probably what's wrong with mine is quite possibly the power supply. I mean, it really is behaving like a rock. So I think that's – when I do get around to it, that's going to be the thing. I know exactly where it is. I know exactly what stratum it's in a pile of Mac related stuff, but I would like to try it out. I mean, ultimately it's kind of a curiosity. It's going to work just like a Mac that runs System 7. You know, I could play the Asteroids game on it or whatever, but
apparently it's based upon the Macintosh, the Quadra 605/LC475.
Oh, you know what that means? Is that it can probably have an Apple II card in it.
Oh, maybe. It looks like it has MPEG-2 and, as a result, MPEG-1 decoding, which I assume is in hardware, and there is an S-video out. So, so it has MPEG hardware. Maybe that's what's plugged into the PDS. I don't know.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think it, because it was intended to be a cable box, it needed to have the ability to do that decoding.
Certainly.
Anyway, so it's sort of interesting. You see them occasionally. This one is starting at Australian $200. So this one is coming out of where? Victoria, Australia. So if I ever do actually manage to get mine to do something, I will report on that, because it would be kind of neat to do. The next one I had is a Spinnaker Better Working Power C for Commodore 64. And I just thought this was a weird thing. I mean, is this? I don't know. Maybe Earl, you find this familiar, but it's. So first of all, I think of Better Working as being kind of like generic software almost, you know. And it is Spinnaker based, but I mean, like, it's sort of, you can get a Better Working spreadsheet and Better Working word processor, and it doesn't seem like the kind of kind of branding you would see for a C compiler. I mean, even apart from the fact that it's a C compiler for the Commodore 64. So is this familiar to you, Earl?
I don't know anything about this particular compiler. Had never heard of it back in the day. don't know about it now. I think I'm always fascinated by language compilers on the old 8-bits, and it would be fun to see how this one works. I'm a little confused by the auction price. I mean, I think $75, I don't know. I don't know if they're going to sell this. I mean, I'm just thinking, do you wake up one morning and go, you know, I mean, with shipping, it's going to be more like closer to 90. I think today I'm going to spend $90 on a C compiler for the Commodore 64. It might be priced too high for my taste, but otherwise, I think it's pretty cool. I've played with a couple of C compilers for the 64 and the Commodore 128, and it's interesting to see how they approach the problem of running in such a small footprint.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess that was one of the things I guess there must be C compilers for the Apple II. I mean, I guess maybe once you got to the 2GS where things were powerful enough.
I think my favorite one was one from Abacus Software, which made a lot of titles for the Commodore line of computers.
Okay, let's see. What was the next thing? I don't know if this is interesting. I'll mention it just because it's made it to the screen. But it's a Sony Magic Link. So this was the what are they called? Magic Cap, kind of Newton-like environment. This particular auction is it's for what was a development kit. So it actually comes with a Magic Link device, but also I think it comes with and a couple of other things. So that's like a headset device here. But I think there's also like a version of Code Warrior for compiling things for this and a programmer's cookbook. You know, so this was basically for the people who are going to write stuff for the Magic Link.
The man behind the iPod, Tony Fadell, had some hand in assisting with the creation of this platform, I recall. I actually have a Magic Link that I found new in box like 15 years ago, but it's a cool little device.
Yeah, I have a few of the things that are, I have a couple of them. And actually, one of the next auctions I had was, I think, the most powerful of the ones that were available, but it got bought before I could say it. But I think I actually had put this up as an auction in some prior list. But it's the what is it called? The Data Rover 840. So I think this was the most powerful of the platform options. You know, so it was the most advanced version of the Magic Cap operating system.
There's actually. Interestingly, have you heard of the Motorola Envoy?
That's the non-Sony one. But actually, maybe this is also non-Sony. This might be the Data Rover may actually be General Magic. Yeah, the Motorola Envoy was the Motorola entry into this, and I have never found one. I've got a search on for it, but I've never seen one.
Yeah, I have an interesting story briefly. The Motorola Envoy, and I'm actually I'm looking through my gallery to try to find there we go. Okay, the Motorola Envoy, Motorola built it. It actually has a built-in, I can't recall the technology, but it has a built-in wireless radio packet network capability that would talk. I don't know if it talked to towers or if it talked to satellites, but if you had the data plan, I remember. I think this was the device. No, there was a version of the Motorola Envoy, if I'm not mistaken, that ran Newton OS, and maybe it had a slightly different name, but they used the same network. I think it was the Iridium network, or at least some of these devices ran the Iridium satellite network. But so the Envoy has, similar. I don't know what particular version of Magic Cap it's running, but. I think it had a larger battery than some of the other devices that ran Magic Cap. But the interesting thing about mine, which is pictured here for those following on YouTube, I got a call from like Georgia or something, and it was a court case. I think it was a murder case, it sounded like, and they needed this as evidence or not, as a demonstration, like in the defense of some client. And they said, what would you like for it? And I came up with a very interesting answer, and they brought me a check, and I sold it to them. I couldn't find the battery. I went out and bought a Radio Shack multi-AC adapter thing to give them power. But I don't think they got the best deal on this device once they told me they were using it for a murder trial. but yes, it's no longer in my collection, and I think I used the proceeds for various other retro projects, which was very nice. But yeah, so that's a strange story about my apparently some dark deeds were done on the Magic Cap device. And
fascinating.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yeah, I do think they're interesting, though. I would like to play more with it. I've got a few Magic Link things, and am curious about the Envoy, but. Okay, let's see. Next one I had, this one is short, but it is, I thought it was sort of interesting. It is an Apple III drive in an Apple, an Apple box. So an Apple III disk III drive. It comes with the little stickers that say like drive 2, 3, 4 that you would put on them to indicate like which is your second, third, fourth drive. The thing actually that I thought was most interesting was just the box. So the box has little check boxes for all the different things that it could have contained. So it could have a disk 2 for the Apple II with or without the interface card, and they had different catalog numbers for those. It could be the Bell and Howell disk 2, which was black, so it matched the Bell and Howell one. Also different catalog numbers for whether it had the controller now that I am looking at it, it doesn't even have a checkbox for the disk 3 that is, in fact, contained within. So, but the serial number matches. So it just I guess it does. It does say disk 3, but the cardboard's ripped. So it's disk 2 with a rip, and underneath it you can see that it's 3, but the catalog number does in fact match the disk 3.
So this is an interesting form factor on this mm-hmm. drive. Do you have any like this, Paul?
Yes. Yeah, I have one actually.
One or two.
Let's see.
Do you have more than 10?
They look basically like disk 2 drive, except if they were made out of like clay or something. They're all sort of rounded, and they sort of match the Apple III. Anyway, I thought the box was cool because you could sort of see all the different kinds of drives that they sold all at the same time, so they would just check the box for whichever one they put in this particular box. And I don't think I've seen this box before, actually. I'll mention this one. I thought I picked Mac OS X Snow Leopard installation DVD. And specifically I picked that because, it's the 10th year and Snow Leopard was still current when the Retro Computing Roundtable started.
Appropriate.
So, and I had a Mac running that version, actually.
New version 10.6.3. I was actually thinking I might try to... So Mac OS X Lion was announced during... Like, actually pretty close to episode 1 of the Retro Computing Roundtable. But it was also the first one that didn't... That there really wasn't physical media for it. So there was no way to buy such a thing on eBay. Like eventually Apple did wind up selling like USB sticks that you could install it with, but it was like a Mac App Store download. So Snow Leopard was the best I could
do.
So if you want to spend $35, you yourself can get a copy of this. And then I think the last thing I'll mention is something that that Ian pointed out, actually. So this is kind of like listener feedback, I suppose. It is a 1980 HP 2647A intelligent graphics terminal. And it just kind of looks cool. It has an interesting rectangular screen. That's sort of an unusual rectangular screen. And I think part of what the reasoning was that it puts the raster lines pretty close together. So you almost can't see them. The individual lines.
It seemed like they did something interesting with the font rendering on there too. They had some trick to mm-hmm. get it really crisp. It looks like one of the terminals that Curious Mark did a series of YouTube videos on. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed watching that series of videos where he was working with it and showing the technical documentation. And actually, I think there was one that he had to do some repair work on.
Yeah, I think that quite possibly could be this one. I'm not certain, but I found a little entry in the HP Computer Museum that talked a little bit about it, and actually at least showed the screen on, you know, so not the one that you could buy specifically on eBay, but you can sort of see what it looks like, and it's, you know, it is a little bit vertically squashed, but it appears from here to be quite clear. Original price $3,500. Catalog reference 1976, so introduced in 1974. This one on eBay is it has a starting bid of $250. It has been on eBay for a long time. Ian sent me this quite some time ago. I followed the relisting links quite a ways to get this into our show notes, but it's neat looking.
I don't think that's a particularly unreasonable price for one of these.
No, I think it would be. It's an interesting one to have. I think it's possible that there are just not enough people who think it's interesting. So
yeah, it's kind of a niche interest.
Yeah. This one is in Ames, Iowa, and if it were to be shipped to me, it would cost a little over $100.
Oh, so yeah.
It starts and getting right at that.
You never know what how one of these terminals, one of these old terminals is going to fare when it gets shipped. The shipper has to be really careful about the packaging.
Yeah. Anyway, that concludes my eBay auctions, but they're still interesting things. Apparently, we had a little bit of discussion earlier ahead of this, talking about the weird bleakness of the eBay landscape this week, just in honor of the 10-year celebration.
It was slim.
Yeah. It did seem a little bit bland.
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's all over now.
Paul, maybe you've bought everything, and therefore no one has anything left to sell. So
you've reached peak eBay, Paul. Well, then I guess we're down to closing arguments. So I think the prosecution goes first. I'm going to forego my parting shots, since I kind of got them all in at the beginning of the show. So I'll just go around the rest of the folks here. Paul, anything to close us out?
I don't have a whole lot to say, really. I found myself doing a lot of editing and not a whole lot else, but that's pretty much been the story for a while. Just yesterday went out and looked at a possible condo. To get that might be sort of interesting. It's not something that I've done before. Buying a house or house equivalent, and so there's a lot of stuff that's involved in that. Turns out, and 2020 is not obviously the best year to do this, but at any rate, it is the year that presented itself. So we'll see how that goes, but.
Well, I wish you luck. Yeah, some parts of that are fun and some parts aren't. So I'll have my fingers crossed for you.
Thanks. Yeah, I think one part of this is going to wind up being being a little bit further away from where my office of stuff is. And possibly, we were talking about renting a little like off-site, not very far off-site, but off-site little storage space that I could put this stuff in. And that could turn out to be actually really quite nice. I'm kind of looking forward to the possibility of having a somewhat spread out space that I can kind of go through things and document and, you know, thin out and stuff like that. But so we'll see. It's not going to be that much fun to move it all, but if I actually can then, you know, at the end, use some of it and get out.
I wonder how many, I have one of those moments that you'll have if.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that could, well, there could be some of that. Or why do I have 15 of these? I thought I only had 9. So.
Well, what about you, Blake? Last chance.
I will say the joys of home ownership. We, you know, single family home for some time. And this year, I think we've managed to spend a number of thousand dollars on cutting down two trees so that they don't fall on the neighbor's house, replacing a toilet and the lines leading to it. And I think our chimney needs to be rebuilt. So, yes, it's been a good way to spend a great deal of money on things that don't actually bring you any joy. But that's, again, part of the maintenance of home ownership. There are good sides to it as well. But this year, this year, for whatever reason, there have been some negatives. As far as the home, only as far as goes home maintenance. But I'm not going to say much about it, but I mentioned it last time, and I'm still liking the getting into vinyl. Mm-hmm. I've been ordering used. It's kind of fun to order used records based on their cover just to find out what they sound like, and cheap on eBay, that kind of thing. I'm looking forward to going to actually Goodwill has a lot of like dollar LPs, and I try not to do much. Social appearances, do many social appearances these days, but I, be hitting that in a bit. And one of the nicer, well, nicer is the wrong word, but one of the more fun things I've acquired recently is Pac-Man Fever.
Oh, yes.
The famous 80s single, Pac-Man Fever. So, nice. I turn that on and, get a little volume going and I really get to see some of my daughter. It's like, oh, I'd like to spend some quiet time with my daughter. Let me pick this on. And she comes running in, trying to thwart the pain of the audio. So that'll bring her. But
I had that whole album on vinyl once upon a time.
Yeah.
That was actually one of few vinyl albums that I had when
really?
I was like a preteen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Whenever that came out, like 82, 83, yeah. I remember having
Buckner
it.
And Garcia.
Like I was not, it was before the time when I was even really choosing music to listen to. Like I listened to what was on the radio basically, but that came out and I was like, yes, I gotta have that.
1981.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And it requires one of the little inserts, the little plastic weird inserts.
Yeah. It does. The table came with it, but mainly I've been doing more. I mean, I've got like 30 albums now, and donations from my wife's childhood stash, back home, and it's fun. So I'm liking it. Definitely enjoying playing with that. But that's all I need to say about that right now. I'll give you an update next time. But how about you, Jack?
I've actually ordered a turntable. So I'm not there yet, but I've ordered a turntable. I found one that plays Bluetooth and it can do 78 if you swap out the cartridge. Like right near where I live in Stockholm, I'm in a short walking distance from a whole bunch of used record stores selling vinyl. Mm-hmm. So I haven't gone. I haven't gone and bought any records yet because I don't want to jump the gun. Like I want to wait until I actually have the turntable so I can make sure that it works and plays a few records that I have, and then I'll start doing what you're doing, shopping for used records.
Nice. I actually had sadly, well, she'd lived a long life. I had an aunt that passed away, but at a very advanced age, and can't be too sad about a life well lived. But she, in her estate, in my direction, came about 278 records, which I can't play.
Oh, wow.
I can't play. And actually, I think I'm going to try to find a home in the neighborhood to some people that might like those. It's not music that's kind of a world away from my own experience, but still interesting that they came. But I can't play them. It's not that common to find the ability just right there in your initial
purchase. Well, you can just really slowly.
Right.
yeah, that's true.
Beyond the speed, it's actually a different cartridge because it's a different groove.
Oh, that's right. I remember I had a 78 capable when I was a kid and you had to actually, I think it was my dad's, and you had to actually turn the needle over. There was
we had one too.
Yep.
We had one too.
Hmm.
Yeah. You'd rotate it, click, and it would be the other needle.
And that presumably was high tech. That was like an innovation, like the ability to have a universal arm that could have both kinds of needles in it.
Because the one that I've ordered, it doesn't have that, but it does have you can pop the cartridge out and another one that is has a 78 stylus.
Yeah, mine just won't. Mine it'll take other cartridges, but it does not. It only runs at 45 and 33 and a third. It doesn't have the RPM speed. So but nice.
And since I was picking one and I saw that some had it, I was like, wait, I should get that because then in case I come across some, you never know, I might come across some crazy old 78 of some jazz band that I want to hear and like. It'd be cool to be able to play it.
Man.
Surely someone released a 78 RPM, you know, Commodore 64 cassette audio program, you know, advertising something. You definitely want to be able to get that data into your C64.
That's right.
Get that
data. I mean, man, 78s were old when I was a kid. So those are from way back.
Yeah,
I remember going down a little YouTube rabbit hole about this a while ago, about the transition from the 78 to the 33 and a third and the 45. And it happened around the time of World War II. And it was a difference in what was used to make the records also. It went from this other thing that's made from like beetle shells or something that the 78s are made with, and it went to vinyl. And but one of the things was the name of the use of the word album that we have today. Previously, before there was like the LP album, you could get a stack of 45s, was a whole album. And they were actually, you purchased them in a little booklet, like a photo album, which I never knew. And then the LP was like, it's a whole album on a single disc.
Long play. Yeah, the 78s in these boxes upstairs that I'm talking about, it's such a short period of time that it takes to get through one side of them that every one of those is in a little binder with like four or five in albums.
Right.
Because it just, you know, it's spinning at 78. It's physically smaller. They're about 10 inches, not 12, I think, or maybe 9. I know 45 is 7, but
Yeah, it's like 9 or 10 inches, but only 2 or 3 minutes, right?
Yeah.
That was definitely my like the few 78s that I've held have been hard, like you know, clearly a different kind of material,
and felt brittle, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're made from shellac apparently, commonly. Mm. Yeah, they're very brittle. Right. I think you know they're quite brittle, and it's interesting.
And there's a comment.
Yeah, see, I've been learning about all this stuff because I've got the turntable.
Yeah, yeah. So, there's a comment that Brandon put in here that Techmoan did a great video about the last of the 78 RPM acoustic players in the 50s. So it could be fun to watch.
Yeah.
That's a great channel.
Side note, the Swedish word for the old 78 records, there's a special name for them. They're called stenkakor, which means stone cakes or stone cookies.
Okay.
I guess just because they are so heavy.
They are heavy. Yeah. Wow. They are really heavy.
Yeah, yeah. You could hurt someone.
Home defense.
Throw one of those at somebody.
The discus.
Or like discus of Tron or something.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. One other thing that note that I had from way at the beginning was that 2010 is where RCR episode 1 was. And another thing that was in 2010 was Tron Legacy. Version of Tron that we all think is like too modern, not like the original and whatever.
Doesn't seem 10 years ago.
That places it. Yeah. Wow.
It's crazy. The iPad was introduced, as RCR began.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we watched it again. Wow. I'm trying to push on through into the next 10 years with this podcast length. But for around Halloween the other night, we watched Halloween H2O, you know, which I actually like that movie with Jamie Lee Curtis. And it's like H2O 20 years later. It's like, well, this is the more modern one. I do like it still, even though it's more modern. It's notably longer than 20 years since that movie was made.
Right. So it's actually closer to the original.
And it was 20 years after the original. Yes, I'm looking at it. Yeah. Like, I probably should not be up this late. I should probably just go to bed for health's sake.
Have you seen the new one?
What's that?
Have you seen the new one that came out 2 years ago?
No, I haven't. I'm too old for that. I'm too old for that crap. I can't watch that.
Well, you know, we used to use the definition back in the day that when a computer hit 10 years old, it was retro. So I guess now the RCR is retro.
Yep.
So I hope somebody is archiving those old episodes.
Now we don't need to actually come up with new topics. We just start, doing
we just recycle.
What was in episode one? What was episode two?
It's syndication from here on out, baby.
Yeah.
Right. The telling of the news is what's retro, in addition to the subject.
That actually might be kind of a cool idea to sort of like, to just go back
through in order and just see, check in on what was happening. You know, in
ooh, the that would one. Be fun this yeah. year in yeah. RCR.
Mm-hmm.
How fun.
Yeah, we could use that to beef up some of the episode
right.
times.
Just great, because like, they really are getting a little yeah. short now.
They're really yeah. short, our episodes. I was going to say, that we're not putting nearly enough time into
so
talking.
So for those yeah. who think that the episodes are a little on the long side, I just want to let you know, we did a comparison of the stats of number of downloads versus the length of the episode and discovered mm-hmm. that the longer episodes had way more listeners. So from now on, we're going for 4 hours.
That's right.
There you go.
So, but I think I will bring this one to a close. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com, all 10 years worth. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org. And while you're there, you can visit the other forums that are there, and they're all awesome. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast, this newfangled Twitter social media stuff. You can join our Facebook group, which is very cool and always has great discussions going on. A link for that in the show notes, facebook.com/group/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network, which you can find at throwbackreviews.com. And if you like the RCR, and if you don't, why are you still listening after 10 years? Come on, guys. So if you do like it, go over to iTunes, please, and feel free to leave a review on there. I've read some of the reviews, and it's always fun to hear from folks how they're liking the show. So after 10 years, lots of fun. 10 more years to come. Until next time, Retro-compute.
Nice.
And that was as synced up as usual.
Yeah. I'm always reminded of, and I forget where I heard it first now, but this, oh, I know, but ending a podcast was like, okay, well, you know, if you did not enjoy yourself and you're still listening to me, the error is yours.
You can't argue with that.
Yeah.
We are not liable for any time invested.
Yeah.
Before we shut down the stream, Josh commented before he liked the selection of microphones on display here. Uh-huh. And he mentioned me having been rocking the old school SM58. That's actually not what this is. This is it looks like an SM58, but it is a Radio Shack microphone from 1986, probably. So I've had this for
good.
Yeah, so I've had this for, you know, 35 years and it still works fine.
It does look like the Shure microphone, yep. though. I mean, nobody would have known if you didn't see anything.
You can see, it's got the realistic brand right there.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, realistic. That's right. That was the kind that you didn't really want your stereo to be.
Yeah.
You know, if you had to, you had to, but it wasn't your choice.
Yep. No, but this thing still works. I don't know.
Sounds good.
Sounds good.
This has been Paul. You have actually used this microphone before, Paul.
That's fantastic.
Because I had this in college. You've surely sung in this mic.
That's great. I like that a lot.
Do you have any recordings of that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Audio. Not much in the way of video, but audio.
There was a video somewhere. I don't think I ever had it. I think Jackie might have had it. We were. Yeah, it was at somebody's house. Dave's house.
I don't know if I've seen that.
Yeah.
Or the video. But yeah. I remember there was a video of us playing at the sales hall, the student union, that my dad took. I don't know where that is.
He kept your Atari stuff, but not this.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to put it on the feed, but man, I got to hear it.
All right. We'll get you some. We'll get you some Scape Dog.
Good times. Right. Shall we say goodbye to YouTube?
We probably should.
Goodbye, YouTube.
And probably goodnight to Jack, because it's probably like 1 a.m. or something now.
Yeah, it's 1 here. It's past 1.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, I might try to get on the tail end of dinner.
Yeah. Okay, I think we have left YouTube now.
Yes.